Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
What's good, internet? It is Monday, October 29th, and you are listening to a very spooky episode of Waypoint Radio, episode 198, the spooky number. It's Halloween this week, and I am your host. There's not a good, like, spooky version of my name.
Austin Centrist Walker.
That would be the spookiest. I've been body doubled and replaced by a secretive NSA program.
David Frum has a good point this week.
I almost voiced the worst possible take that I saw this weekend, and I can't do it because it's too bad. So I'm going to move on. How are y'all doing this spooky Halloween week?
I'm good. I've managed to watch remarkably most of the Halloween movies I committed myself to, both Halloween movies in the Halloween movie canon and Halloween movies around my Shocktober list. So
nice.
I'm feeling good about that.
Patrick Klepek also joining us, Danielle Riendo.
Hi, I'm feeling very spooky. This is my favorite holiday, and it makes me very happy.
It's a good one.
I might march in the parade this year.
Is there a Halloween parade?
Yes.
Oh, I did that. I didn't do it once, but I stumbled out into the remnants of it once. I used to have a job as a trademark researcher, and that was probably the least healthy hours I've ever kept in my life. I was working 12-hour days, 5 days a week.
Well, that's shocking.
Right?
Yeah, it doesn't surprise any
of
us.
No, it was, like, worse than I'd ever been. It's, like, truly... here's the real thing. I was just bad at the job. Like, I was... Uh-huh. This was not, I'm going to be the best. I was like, if I'm not here until 10 p.m., I'm not going to get everything I need to get done. And so on Halloween, I was there alone in the office until, like, 10 or 11 p.m.
Ooh, spooky.
That is a ghost story.
This is, like, yeah, right? This is 2007, 2008. It's 2007, I want to say. No, it was 2008. And I was extremely still on a Bioshock kick because it was a decade ago. And I was that dude. And so I was listening to the Bioshock soundtrack when I left. And so, like, Under the Sea or something was playing. And I wandered out into downtown Manhattan. And it was just like, I was surrounded by people in costumes. And I was like, I'd forgotten it was Halloween, right? I was just working all day. I was like, oh, shit. Like, something happened while I was working. The apocalypse hit. It's the purge, baby. And it was a good, like, 3 minutes. Because it was like, I was working near the waterfront, which there's not a lot of people there. But as I moved towards my subway, I started seeing more and more people in stranger and stranger costumes. It was a good time. It was a good time to be afraid. Rob Zachney, are you afraid of anything?
I mean, constantly of everything. But mostly I'm interested in pragmatic solutions.
Rob, is this about subterfuge again?
Boy, there's a lot of angst and anxiety about that right now.
Yeah.
If we're talking about, like, what made this weekend spooky, first of all, I don't feel like I had a weekend. I did, it was a gorgeous fall weekend. I did a ton of, like, baking, total, like, it's cold enough now that, like, it doesn't heat up the house too badly to do a bunch of cooking. And that was a lot of fun. But when I wasn't doing that, I had the stack of games I really wanted to be playing.
Uh-huh.
But I kept being like, I'll start my gaming time after I check my subterfuge.
Yep.
Yeah. Oh. And
you're
so
good
we
at
are...
this game is the thing. We are both okay at this game, and what that actually means is we spend time on it. I think there are other players in this game who do the thing you're saying, which is like, I'll just check in for 5 minutes. You don't do that.
No, not this time. I'm probably a little more this is the we're playing with anonymous accounts this time. Mm-hmm. Like, this one is live ammunition. Like, this is not for fun. This is not for play. Like, we're here to play some fucking subterfuge. Or I thought we were.
Uh-huh. Well, what's that mean?
So, the thing is, subterfuge, and this is going to be, like, I have not worked out how I feel about this.
Yeah.
There's a couple schools of thought about subterfuge.
Mm-hmm.
One, and I think this is expressed by our mutual friend, Salt of the Earth, Less Evil Nick.
Less Evil Nick, yeah.
Yeah.
Nick is Nixed.
Yeah.
Shout out to Evil Nick, Nick Capizzoli.
Not
also.
Capo.
Yeah.
Yeah, Capo is chaotic evil. Like, so, like, bad Nick, definitely. Mm-hmm. But the thing about a game like Subterfuge, and this is true of a lot of, like, competitive, like, strategy games or multiplayer games that are sort of built on, like, betrayal mechanics, is how bought into the victory conditions is every player. Some games kind of require this, right? Like, if you sit down at a board game, for instance.
If you sit down to play poker, everyone has to play to win poker.
Right. Otherwise, the game doesn't really work.
You can't be
if you're helping somebody across the table, you're cheating.
Right. Or if you sit down to play poker and you're like, I'm going to try to get all the diamonds. Like, no, that's not what this game is. You can't, like, I'm always going to bet every turn. Like, no, you can't. That's not, you're not going to win. We all have to agree. This is where, like, competitive games are actually secretly cooperative games because everyone agrees to play the same fucking game.
This is like my friend in fantasy football who decided, fuck it this year and just drafted 13 quarterbacks so he could just take them all off the board.
Oh my God. That's amazing.
It was extremely funny, and then he just started making trades afterwards.
Sure. That's very funny. So yeah, Rob, continue. Sorry.
Yeah, so I mean, subterfuge, like, there's only one winner per game, and it does give you a sop to, like, people who finish strong. So there's, like, a podium finish. And the one school of thought is that everyone should be playing for that top spot. Like, if you are not playing for the top spot, you are effectively, like, kind of breaking the dynamics of the game. Like, everything that drives subterfuge is this idea that at any moment somebody could be about to backstab you and make their play for the number one position. This is the theory of subterfuge. This is how the game was designed. I have never, in all the games I've played of subterfuge, including this one, seen that game of subterfuge. Never right. happens. Because that is a very hard way, like, it's easy to play, like, a betrayal game mechanic if you're sitting down and playing for, like, I don't know, 2 hours, 3 hours with a board game.
You're playing Battlestar Galactica or something like that. We're like, oh, I'm going to be the Cylon tonight. That's exciting. They're called Cylons, right? This is a huge...
Yes, you're okay. Correct.
Mm-hmm. I've seen more of original Battlestar Galactica than the new Battlestar Galactica, and that is a serious fault in my life. I know. I'll fix it. I'm sorry. I'm trying to delete it.
But yeah, so anyway, so... The thing is, like, subterfuge goes on, and people don't want to feel like shit for days. I don't want to feel like shit for days, but I want to win, so I'm willing to. But a lot of people get in there, and after the first, like, moves are made, they start to realize, like, I'm not sure I'm in this. Like, I'm not sure I want to be doing this. This feels weird. Or they're simply not that invested in winning that spot. They're not going to be, like, living on their phone trying to, like, conspire and connive. And so every game of subterfuge has involved people playing suboptimally because they're trying to fulfill other goals specific to themselves. And that throws the game into a little bit of chaos. But the other school of thought is, part of subterfuge is recognizing and anticipating what do people actually want? What are they playing for? And building that into your calculations, like understanding motivation. But it gets pretty weird when you do have to understand, like, in this deeply competitive, betrayal-driven game, there are people who don't actually want to do any of that and just want to have a nice time.
They're like, oh, I'm going to play and I'll make a friend and we'll just hang out over here in this part of the city. Or the other thing that can happen is, like, for instance, over the weekend I tweeted that there is a war happening in this game of subterfuge. And because it's a game where you don't have perfect information, there's, like, a big fog of war outside of your holdings. Like, there's a war going on that I don't know shit about. There are two sides that I can't see on my map. I can see just the edge of one of them, and I can't see the other one at all. And my understanding is they're, like, they've been going at it for 3 days now, and I have no idea what's happening
are
there.
They?
I believe so, based on the fact that my border emptied of units, and I took advantage of that because that person thought that their border with me was safe. They were wrong. Right, but, like, the thing that you were getting at is there are definitely players who want from this for everyone to be all the way in, to be hyper conniving, hyper, like you described it as just like a sociopathic backstabbers, right? Like that's what some people
megalomaniacal. Think. Like it had to be this combination of traits.
Yes. Yes. It's like everyone is constantly daggers out. And there are other players who just want to like, who want to play it as if it's just an RTS and it's just about moving units around and not at all about conniving and diplomacy and strategy in terms of psychologically reading your opponents or your rivals and trying to play them against each other and et cetera. And I definitely fall somewhere in the middle. And I think the game is pretty healthy for me in that way, which is nice. Danielle.
Can I ask you a question?
Always.
I've never played this game.
Yeah.
I can see myself playing this game and getting so into it, getting so into the role-playing aspect that it would bleed into not only my real life in terms of waking up at 3 a.m. and doing something, but like actively trying to get an opponent like in real life under the influence of something and like try to get them to spill information. Is this a thing that happens? Like say your friend is at a party and you're like, have a beer. Yeah. Oh, blah, blah, blah. Like, does this happen?
I mean, I think it happens in a conversational sense. Like, Rob and I have exchanged information. Things have happened in the game where like, holy shit, what is blank doing? Right? And part of that is honest and real because you are surprised by what happened. But it would also be a good thing if you were able to like get a little extra info out in that conversation. Mm-hmm. Okay. It instrumentalizes interaction in a way that can be scary, believe it or not, spooky. It's am I talking to this person because I have genuine interest in what they're going to say, or because they can give me information that I can't obtain by myself? Ooh.
Oh.
Weird.
And the real hell of subterfuge is that you were doing both. And that is the uncomfortable thing about subterfuge, and this is why the game leaves me feeling like I need the longest hottest shower like in world history, is that in subterfuge, you get really comfortable, you don't get comfortable with it, but you start to understand how you can have both good motivations that are also corrupt motivations simultaneously, and those live side by side. And the other thing is this, you may realize that that echoes other ways you behaved in your life, like all those things where like you do something nice to somebody, like for somebody, but also like you kind of wanted a little credit for that, right? You wanted you wanted them to owe you one.
Yeah.
And those two, but like you tell yourself like, oh, I'm a good, like I just did that. I wanted to do a solid for this person. But you knew on some level that also you would have a marker at that point. Subterfuge puts that front and center. That like, subterfuge like puts that transactional nature of human relationships front and center and says, well, everything is both. Like you're never just doing a nice thing. You're always doing a nice thing with an angle. Mm-hmm. And the thing that sucks about subterfuge is as you begin to like play it, you start to wonder like, is this just me? Like, is this how I roll? And I don't think it is. But when I play subterfuge, I start to wonder.
Yeah.
And it starts to like recast, like subterfuge makes me think about shitty things in my past and like ugly, like, you know, career, like make or break moments that I've had. And subterfuge like makes me relive that shit.
Yeah, no, it's, the thing that I tweeted last night is that I suspect every subterfuge game has a point at which the arc of the game mirrors some arc in your life. And for me, it is saying yes all the time. It is like someone saying, hey, could you do this? And me going like, okay, if I say yes, how can I spin that to be I see that request and I go, okay, is there a way for me to help them with this thing in a way that helps me also? But yeah, I can figure it out. If I move to the, okay, that'll be outside of the sonar range of so-and-so, and then, or I can gift them this, and then, okay, where I can distract by pulling up over here. And what has ended up happening in this game is I have, honestly, none of my fronts are secure at this point. And on paper, the last 2 days, I have been number one, number two, number three, somewhere in there, pretty consistently. Like, wow, look at how well this player is doing. But the response has now been, the edges are crumbling. The walls are falling in. The fact that I extended myself so far is coming home to roost, because I can't, you know, I can't react very quickly. I can't react. I don't have a lot of flexibility in how I want to do stuff. I have to. The structure that I've built for my life has taken over the possibility space and has limited what I can do. So, in my case, yes. Yes, yeah. Subterfuge is a pretty useful psychological profiling tool.
Yep.
It's too real.
We'll be done soon. No, we won't. We just entered the mid-game. The top of our screen now says, at current mining rate, Brown will win in 18.1 days. It will not take 18 days, but we've just entered the mid-game, kind of. It'll probably be over by this time next week, I fucking hope. Rob and I are going to start doing some diaries now that it's late enough in the game that we can do that without kind of showing our own hands, you know? So look forward to those this week. Any other spooky games?
I'm playing a spooky game.
Oh, yeah? What are you playing?
I'm playing a game. It came out last month, I think. It's called Stay.
S-T-A-Y.
S-T-A-Y, yes. Cool. It's from the Abnormals team. It's published by P-Cube. Those are the people who made it and published it. That's what I know about that.
Okay.
I don't know anything else that Abnormals did, so I'm sorry. But it's a really cool little thriller. So, it came out on PS4 last month, so I'm not sure. It may have been out earlier in the year on Steam. But what it is a cool little sort of pixel art thriller. It's a little bit Telltale style adventure with a much more limited scope. So you are on the other end of a computer. There's a little guy. His name is Quinn. He has been knocked out and he has awoken in like a dark room that has a computer. And that's it. And that's all you know. And you are sort of the lifeline on the other side. You don't have perfect information. Mm. You have no idea what happened to him. He has no idea what happened to him. And you're both kind of trying to figure it out together. So it's sort of you just being the other side of the screen. And sometimes you take control of Quinn and you do puzzles, like in the room. Like, oh, you know, you can direct him to scratch the wallpaper and maybe he'll find a clue or maybe he'll find something to do. And there'll be a little, you know, puzzle associated with that sort of thing. But otherwise, you're just sort of making dialogue decisions. And, you know, there's like a little, it doesn't say Quinn will remember that, but there's it's basically like a, that kind of style of thing is going on. I'm three chapters in so far, I think. So I'm not done yet with the game. Apparently there are something like 19 rooms in the house. I'm still only like a few rooms in. It's very effective thus far in being a sort of like, I wouldn't call it Saw style, but it is that sort of like a puzzle room and a creepy mystery is happening. I could see it falling into a potential pitfall because Quinn is a self-described terrible therapist. Like, he is a therapist, and he says something like, I could see a patient or two of mine doing something like this. So there is a potential pitfall here for some bad, crappy mental illness stuff, for sure.
The horror handling mental illness.
I know, right?
Jeez,
I know.
What a spooky revelation.
Can you imagine? So it's possible that it falls into some tropes. It hasn't yet. It's actually been really, really kind of exciting. I sort of cozied up to it last night because I've been trying to do this thing last couple of weeks where I'm trying to play like smaller horror games, like really very, very small.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Like
you mentioned the Kitty Horror Show collection from last week.
Yeah, and I know Mo, our awesome community person, Mo, was playing Paratopic this weekend.
I need to play it so bad.
Oh, it's so good. I love Paratopic.
Yeah, I'll get there this year.
Yeah, it's worthwhile. It's like an hour long and a very, very, very cool experience. It does really cool things with jump cuts. That's a thing.
Ooh,
Paratopic does well.
Cool.
So, yeah, Blink Stay, it's cool.
I need you to spoil, like, if this happens, I need you to come back and spoil this because I just want to know this. If it happens, if I've called this. If you're some kind of jigsaw tile type motherfucker in this, who like set this up and the whole game's like, oh, like this is the prey inside your little, you know, they think you're helping, but like really you're torturing them and you become like complicit in like the torture killing of this person. Just let me know. Because like if seeing that like, this game looks cool, but if that's where it goes with the premise, like I don't think I need to see that turn.
You're
like,
good.
I think I know what's up.
Yeah, fair. I will let you know. I will send you a subterfuge message.
Yeah.
And then you'll be able to figure out if I was trying to transactionally, you know, get something from you or not, or get you to play the game or not play the game. There's many levels here.
Can I actually just say briefly, you say I'll send you a subterfuge message. One of the conversations that popped up over the weekend in subterfuge was that for me, like, so everything Rob said about it being a stressful game, 100% true. Also, I don't look at Twitter first thing in the morning anymore. I look at subterfuge. So it's already better for my mental health. It's just like, so much easier to care about submarines and drills and mines than it is to look at the fucking news and everyone's terrible takes before like 11 a.m. So that has been a nice treat over the weekend.
Very fair.
So catch me there. Leaving Mastodon, as we decided in the subterfuge game, we're all just gonna live in subterfuge now. Just join games randomly and hope we're in them. You know. Also, we'll be anonymous, so there's no way for you to know if you're talking to me or not.
Wow, you really thought this one through, Austin. I can't wait for this new future.
Yeah, finally we made it. No likes though. No likes.
It's a better platform, really, for discussion and figuring out people's real intentions. So.
God. Anything else? Any other spooky stuff this week, or are the rest of us just heads down in Red Dead Redemption 2?
I had a spooky story that started out Red Dead Redemption 2.
Oh yeah? What was your spooky story?
I came across. There was a man, and I
with a data cap.
Damn. Cuts.
So, you come across a lot of people in this game, you know, just like wandering the plains, wandering the mountains, and you don't know what was going to happen. I've only played 6 or 7 hours, and so there was a man and he was yelling. I'm like, I'm going to go see what's up with all this yelling. So I wander over and I get off my horse, and he's like, he looks at me, goes, "Hey," and he starts to walk toward me, and then his horse kicks up and bashes his face and the horse kills the man, and then the horse runs away, and I looted him and I left.
Great. That's scary.
That's good.
That's the good stuff right there.
It was so weird though, like he's dealing with his horse and his horse fucking kicked him in the face and it killed, like,
that's terrifying. Yeah. So
nothing but your chains.
That's right. I'm with horse.
Good for you, horse.
Hashtag I'm with horse.
Wow.
There's so many ways to talk about this game. I guess, like, first and foremost, I should say, if you haven't had a chance to go back and listen to our coverage of the labor issues with this game and talk about the initial, like, 100-hour work week comment from Dan Houser, or the follow-up conversation that we had after Jason Schreier's piece on the labor conditions across Rockstar's many studios, go back and listen to that first. Like, I don't think we have the time today to relitigate all the stuff we said, and I stand by everything we already said. So I would point there, and I want to say, but I do want to say that in playing it, I think I'm always caught in a moment of thinking about that stuff, or so often I'm thought of thinking, I'm caught thinking about that stuff. And maybe no more than when the game succeeds for me. Every time there's something like really cool happens, there is some part of me that's like seeing the hours put into it, right? And wondering, oh, is this one of those things that had to be QA tested in a moment of non-volunteer kind of a mandatory overtime? Is this one of those things that was sent back to somebody a dozen times? Or it happens the other way too. You know, Jason Schreier's piece opens with that anecdote about the black bars.
Oh, that's the thing, dude. The black bars don't add anything.
It sucks so bad.
If anything, it actually takes me out of the game. It doesn't work in an IMAX effect.
If I could turn it off, I would turn it off.
The thing is, I'll just say this about the black bars.
Uh-huh.
These are not filmmakers who made this game.
Yeah, I noticed.
And it shows, like, the framing, like, the idea that putting black bars on something and, like, gives you, a wider aspect ratio and that makes it somehow more cinematic, you have to use that frame, you have to compose that frame, and, like... First of all, there's just so much of this game. How can you compose every single one of these sequences beautifully?
Especially because they were already composed without the bars, and then you're editing those shots. Those shots weren't conceived of first and foremost in that way. They shot those sequences, then they had to go in and edit those sequences and reshoot them with presumably with the same basic structure. And like, one, doing that in a rush because it was towards the end of production means you're going to do it worse than if you'd done it early on. I would love to see the version of this game that just didn't have them and had whatever the original shots were. But regardless, my deeper point is that, like, I can tell you all sorts of great stories from this game already. I mean, I think we'll get into our issues with the game too, for what it's worth. I don't think it's like I don't think it's a perfect game. It doesn't stand up to me to like something like Breath of the Wild, which completely floored me as a player. I was, you remember, I came in just like, glowing about that game, but there are still moments in this that are doing the thing I love in games. I guess the thing that I should say is, like, I'm someone who, in tabletop RPGs, there was a moment in the near past where designers realized, and I'm being really reductive here, but realized that binary success and failure is really boring. That, like, you roll the dice. Did you do it? Yes. Did you not do it? No. Is super, super dry. Because what happens is you go into a room and you look for clues, or you're trying to pick a lock and you fail and you go, okay, well, I guess we don't get to open that door. I guess you just don't get to know what's behind that door. Shrug. And instead, now what a lot of great tabletop games do is they go, okay, well, there's a space for mixed success or partial success. Like, where, okay, you open the door, but your lockpick breaks. You open the door, but you make noise and the guard down the hall hears you and is going to rush over to investigate. It complicates things. And in this past year has been a lot of games that aren't great at not a lot, but a lot of the big AAA games, especially big open world games like Assassin's Creed Odyssey, aren't interested in that partial success for me. There are moments when they do, but by and large, those games have felt very frictionless. They're there for me to, like, succeed in. Red Dead is there for me to fuck up in. Partially, I'm fucking up because I think the controls are a disaster.
I cannot remember what half the things do.
Totally.
Where's my satchel again? How do I change my compass?
I'm getting there, but it's taken me 15 hours.
I'll say, but you must be like 20 hours more in it. Maybe 6 or 7 hours. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But like, yeah, I mean,
I'm still being tutorialized things still.
Also, don't put that stuff in the upper left-hand corner where it's easy to fucking miss it, and you'll constantly be doing tutorial stuff while 100%. You're doing things in the game.
But the thing it does do well is things like, so I had this moment when I was playing on Friday where, you know, there, like you said, there are these open world moments where there's just people out in the world. And so I was going somewhere or another and I saw, okay, no, what I'd done is I'd done this series of loan shark quests, which happened early on to introduce you to the taking care of the camp stuff. And I had like just come back from a really rough one where I, you know, they are framed as being negative. They are framed as Arthur, like, being the strong man for this loan shark and who's part of your crew. And in Arthur's journal, he's, like, writing about how awkward it makes him feel and bad. And, like, he's hurting people who are already on the outs, their recent arrivals, blah, blah, blah. And I think that stuff mostly hits. I think a lot of the story stuff is mixed. But I think the loan shark stuff worked for me. And so I was just like, man, I feel like an asshole. Like, I just beat up this poor farmer who, like, has nothing and, like, couldn't even give me shit. So I'm going to fuck off and maybe I'll try to do good. And so I rolled up on this kind of like overturned stagecoach that had two corpses in it and a dude who was looting those corpses. And I was like, hey, partner, what are you doing? Like, what's going on? And he was like, this isn't your business. Get out of here. And I was like, I think it's my business now. And pulled a gun on him and he pulled a gun on me and then I shot him. And I'm like, all right, well, whew, did some good. Now let me go loot this guy because, of course. So I go to loot him, and then someone else runs over and is like, oh, no, I got to go tell the sheriff about this, and, like, starts, like, riding away really quick. And I turn and target them, and I yell, like, there's, like, a stop witness thing. And Arthur is like, and again, this goes to show the, like, the amount of labor that goes into making something like this. He goes, like, no, you don't understand. The thing that I wasn't involved in the killings. Like, very specific dialogue.
Contextually, Arthur's trying to get himself off the hook.
Off the hook, exactly, exactly.
That's really neat.
It's really neat. So I start chasing after this guy. And I...
On foot or on horse?
I start on foot, and I'm shooting in the air to get him to stop. He is not stopping.
Oh, my God.
I call my horse.
Will that work?
Yeah, totally. If you hit... Oh, so again,
and in the game.
If you, if you target somebody with a gun out and then hit up on the D-pad, and then hit up the D-pad, you aim your gun up.
Oh, right.
And then that triggers, like, a like, stop in your place, asshole type thing. So then I call my horse. I chase him down. I lasso him and pull him off the horse, but I... guess I pull him off the horse in a way that kills him just as another another stagecoach is coming past and they see me and they are going into a direction I've never seen before. And they're like, we got to get out of here. We got to go tell the cops or what at the lawman. So I'm like, fuck.
Now you got to cross off an entire stage's worth of people.
Well, so it's two people and they're in like a stagecoach is probably, it's a wagon. This is definitely more of a wagon. And it's two, it's like, I don't know. It's two friends. It's two dudes who are on this thing. Maybe they're lovers. Who could say? They seem to carry each other a lot because I chase them down. I'm like, stop what you're doing right now. And I cannot get close enough to lasso them because they have rifles. And one of them is like lining up shots and shooting at me. So I'm like, man, fuck it. And I shoot that one. And the other one like pulls to a stop. And the guy gets out the car, and I pull up next to him, like, stop right now. And he gets off the wagon, and he's like, it's fine. I'm like, okay, it's okay, 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 okay. I've already lost so much. And I'm like, get out of here. I'm not going to get out of here. So I'm like, okay, fuck, where the hell am I? And I realize I'm, like, in a swamp now. I spent the whole part of this game previously in this, like, beautiful Heartland area, the area you're probably in, Patrick, the kind of, like, early game, or not the intro, but the early game is this, like, kind of rolling green hills and forests and, you know, lakes and a river that splits things apart. And, like, it's like the American, like,
if you told Heartland. Me Montana, I would just sort of think something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, it's gorgeous. It's really, really pretty. And now I was in this, like, murky swamp. And I checked my map and saw that I was actually close to this mission that I hadn't even thought about doing yet because I was so far away from it, called, I forget what it's called specifically, but there's this group of gunslingers that you're hired to go identify and interview and take photos of early on in the
game. Oh, yeah, there's like six of them that you can go.
Yeah, and so
the Sinister Six.
Yeah, so it's like Black Belle, this woman who's like a, you know, in her mid-40s and is like a former bounty hunter and gunslinger.
That Black Belle one is really far
So that is where I stopped that other stagecoach, was like, 60 seconds away from that. So I was like so far away. So I'm like, I'll roll over and do that mission. I did that mission. That mission was whatever. That mission was fine. She seemed really cool. And I killed all these dudes in that mission. She gets attacked in that mission. You kind of like help her withstand waves of bounty hunters. It reminded me a little bit of the stuff in Red Dead 1 that was not great. The like defend a point from the waves and waves of enemies stuff.
But at least this is a side mission as opposed to like a central like moment in the game's story.
And so I killed all these dudes and she escapes and blah blah blah. I guess light spoilers for that, apologies. Whatever, it's not a main thrust of this game. And then I'm like, all right, I'm gonna go loot these guys and I'm gonna head back west. And I go to loot them and I realize they have sunk into the mud. And immediately my mind is like, fuck, how many people and how many hours and how much talent went into seeing them sink into the mud? Like, I shot somebody and they were like in the mud in a way that I don't know that I've seen in many games at all. If you drag them around.
But it didn't seem like a glitch, like when the Assassin's Creed ship falls to the ocean.
All right, not like that at all. Just like literally, just they had fallen so hard that they fell deep into the mud. And I was walking through the mud and my feet were like being left in. So I was immediately thinking again about like, how hard is it to make a game like this? And then I was ripped from that kind of deeper, like, oh man, I don't do labor, because a guy rode up on a horse and was like, oh mister, I'm feeling really sick, you gotta help me. And I turned and looked at it. I was like, what do you need? Like, I have medicine. You know, like, maybe I can walk up. And there had been other times when someone had said, I saw someone get a snake bite once, and they were like, yeah, give me something to help me. And I'm like, oh, here's some medicine. This guy was like, no, I need to go to a doctor. He fell off the horse. And I was like, shit, all right. And my game gave me a waypoint. And it gave me a waypoint in a place I'd never been, even further east, called Saint-Denis, which is like their – I knew that was the name of the big city in this game. I was like, wow, I thought that didn't open up until later, because I'd skimmed through Kirk Hamilton's review of the game, and he talks about the moment that you arrive in that city. There's some narrative stuff that goes along with it that for Kirk...
It's like a big deal,
deal, right, exactly. There's a major NPC who's talking to you, who's like, look at this city. This is what civilization really is. Like, I'm judgy, etc. Like, here's the theme of this game. But I didn't get that. That wasn't my first time going to Saint-Denis. I'm sure I'll get that cutscene later. My first time going to Saint-Denis was picking up this sick dude, putting him on the back of my horse, and just fucking bolting through the swamps and marshes and eventually bayous as I arrived in this kind of turn-of-the-century New Orleans-style city. Cobblestone streets, deeply, deeply dark. Another thing that happened in the moment is, like, Patrick, I don't know if you've noticed this, or Rob, I don't know how far in you are, but, like, the nights are really bright out in the Heartlands because there's so many stars, and
the moon is just, it's a light
sun.
Source.
Yeah, totally. And I'd written down, I was, like, upset about it because I thought the nights were too bright. But as I got closer and closer to Saint-Denis, all of that light faded, either from the illumination of the city and the light pollution, or just because of the industry and the smoke in the air or whatever. And it got so dark, and it got dense with fog and mist and soot, and I could see the gas lights of that town in the distance in the middle of the night, just like at once illuminating the streets, but also kind of blinding me because they were so bright and everything else was so dense. And I just go fucking just storming through this city on my horse, just like roaring through it. I don't know anything. I've never been here before. I guess in game, I guess Arthur theoretically knows where there's a doctor. Otherwise, I don't know why there's a fucking waypoint on my map. But I end up like taking a turn and clipping a dude with my horse. And everyone starts yelling, and they're like, and I get the wanted for unarmed assault. And I just like, fuck it, I'm going to ride away. I got to get this guy to this doctor. I'll deal with that
You're
afterwards.
You're just an ambulance at this
exactly.
point.
Exactly. You just clip people sometimes. And so I keep moving.
Sometimes you got to make patience.
Sorry, say that one more time.
Sometimes you got to make patience.
That's wow, geez. Yeah.
Danielle loves being an EMS. We all know that.
So I clip this guy. I get the thing that's wanted. And then I get to the doctor before the people behind me are just like, what do you, stop. You hit somebody or whatever. I pull in front of the doctor and there's a cop already outside. And I'm like, fuck. And the thing I hate about Rockstar open world games, the thing I hate about open world games in general, is that there is almost always a universal wanted meter where it's like everybody knows all at once magically that I did some shit. But this cop goes like, hey, I think people are calling for you back there. Hey, mister, you got to go back and deal with whatever happened back there. And I'm like, no. And the thing to know is about this game is that there's a horse loyalty meter. And... you gain that by like patting your horse or by like feeding it nice.
Yeah, it's really satisfying.
It's so nice to pet animals in general in this game. The animal stuff is really good.
Like, yeah, like the idea that when you're, if like a grizzly bear makes a noise off to the side, like if you're rolling through a forest, it'll spook your horse and then it can knock you off. But early on when you're building that loyalty, if you hold R3, you'll pet him like, hey, it's okay. You can get him. It's one of those like small detail mechanics that I thought I was going to be annoyed by, and instead, the first time it happened, where I heard this like big, enormous bear growl off to the side, couldn't see him. Horse got spooked. I was just like, he calmed down. We kept about our business. I was like, oh, this is delightful.
So it is. It really is. I like all of that stuff the most. And so when you get your horse bond up, when you get enough horse points, you start to learn tricks. And the first trick you learn is that you can rear up if you hit the like slow down button and X at the same time. And so this cop is like, you got to go back the other way. And I'm like, stop. I don't want to hit this cop. Rear up. And the sick dude falls off my horse and cracks his skull on the ground. And I hop off. And the cop is like, listen, mister, you got to go deal with whatever they're talking about back there. And I'm like, I grab the body and like throw it over my shoulders. He's dead. In my heart of hearts, I know he's dead because the doctor waypoint has vanished from my map. But I still go in because I'm still like, I got to get this guy to the fucking doctor. So I just like run in.
I said I'd do this
thing. Right, I said I would do this thing. And the doctor is out front and he's like, can I help you? And I target him and doesn't let me do anything because this guy is dead and the game is smart, but it's not that smart. It doesn't know that I just killed him out front.
Right.
So I run into the operating room and I'm trying to drop this guy and I cannot drop this guy. Like I there's not enough room on the ground for me to drop him, and I think because I'm in an interior it won't let me just drop a body. And the cop comes in and he's like, all right, sir, I've told you enough times, you know, there are people back there or whatever. He's like, I told you enough times, you got to come with me now. And then like the blip that's like, you know, when you haven't done anything too bad, you can surrender. And so I'm like, fuck it. You know what? Fuck it. Hit surrender. And Arthur just kind of like throws up his hands. I think the body just in that animation falls off of me and onto the ground. And then it cuts from that. And it's like, you could fake surrender. You could like fight back at this point. I was like, fuck it. You know, let me spend a couple of nights in the fucking clink. Like, and it just like cuts to Arthur in there asleep. And then it opens
up. You probably got your stamina up.
I got my stamina up. I rested a little bit. Yeah, exactly. And I walked out. I had $3 to my name. And there was like a little vaudeville theater right across the way. So I went in, spent my last $2 on the ticket. Watched a guy do some magic tricks with a bullet. Watched a flame spitter. And heard someone sing Hello, My Darling. So... that was like...
and an alien popped out.
Right. This was this like 45-minute sequence from the first people who I saw on the side. Or from like from the moment I finished that loan mission to this moment.
Right.
And so much of it was things going wrong in a way that arose from friction in the gameplay. And like that is what I love about... that's what I love about games like Far Cry 2. It's what I love about games like Dragon's Dogma. Is that sense that like... I'm making choices that are not only that where I can be successful in my immediate intention, but can have knock-on consequences that complicate things for me. And all throughout that whole experience, I did keep coming back to this question of the labor stuff of just like, how do you get this right? Like this city seems so dense and so big, and it is. Like I've now seen that city in the daylight, and it's like I don't know that I've seen like that's not true.
GTA 5 definitely has big, really hyper detailed cities. But I didn't expect one in Red Dead, because normally when I think about Red Dead, I think about big open plains and like tiny little settlements.
It stands out in contrast to the rest of the house. How deeply sparse so much of this world. Like, it's such an enormous world. Like, Red Dead Redemption is a big world, but this is, like, just exponentially bigger. So there are just so many long, quiet moments where you will either see nothing, or you'll just see rabbits, or you'll see the occasional person on a horse. But you can go 5 minutes
and so to see this place that's, like, hyper-dense with, like, laundries and little sub-communities is a lot. Danielle?
So, quick question. I haven't played any of this yet. I keep thinking about Novigrad. As you're talking about the city, I keep thinking about Witcher 3, and I'm wondering
if
there are comparisons here, or if that's Novigrad's
probably a bigger and denser city than this is,
okay,
for sure. But it had a similar effect for me of like getting to Novigrad was a relief for me after spending so much time out in the swamp. Yeah, exactly. I forget what the name of that place is.
Velen.
Yeah, Velen, out in Velen. It's like, oh my god, finally there's all these people. And immediately, of course, it's like, yeah, fuck people. This place sucks too. Everywhere sucks, right? but what it didn't have was this, like, you know, I don't know. I'm still so early in this game that I don't know I don't know if it hits its thematic ideas in a way that will stick with me, or a way that will provide insight or perspective on questions I hadn't answered yet. So far, I'll say no. So far, it has been very much like a lot of white folks saying that they want to live free and like they don't want the government to sweep in. And it's not to say there aren't characters of color. There are you know, two black cowboys in your group. One of them is a half Native American. I don't think that stuff is done particularly well. You know, when you have one Native American character in your crew, and he's the one who like teaches you to hunt and teaches you the value of.
Boy.
And there's something I think is sort of interesting around his own the
writing of the character is more interesting than what he is used practically to teach, like, Arthur. So like, if you separate the two, like the conversations I've had with that character have been interesting.
Yeah, and there's
but like the what you're speaking to of like his use of like the one half Native American, like, okay, get out there with the bow and arrow, because his hand
he's
is
gonna teach you how
broken.
To track,
like,
and how to
like that's not great and could have been done in any number of other ways, considering this is probably a camp in which like most people need to like there's no way there's just one tracker in this group, given how much they're on the run. But like, separate from that, like the long conversation you have with him, and like when you're heading into to the first camp, I think he's on like the wagon with you, and you hear a little more about his backstory.
Hosea,
like, the writing on that stuff is stronger than I expected.
I think the writing in general of that core set of characters has been stronger than I expected, but I think that's because my expectations are coming right off of Red Dead, which we all played a bunch of. And boy, like, my expectations could not have been fucking lower as far as the writing is concerned coming off of that, because of characters like Irish and Seth, who were just like, and even Javier, who's in this game again, but like was not a particularly well-written character in the first game. And here there is I don't want to say like there's a seriousness to the game, but they aren't trying there are enough characters around you who they are doing their ambition is to do Bonnie McFarland, not to do Irish, not to do Seth.
Yeah.
Right.
And they're also spreading these traits out amongst more characters. And so there's at least seemingly early on, less of like a compression of a bunch of like archetypes, stereotypes, like, not that stuff isn't like present in parts of the world, but it seems like just because there's a larger cast of characters, you can just do more with it. They can be something more hyper specific than, they're less broad than they were the first.
I've still hit those really bad character caricature style characters. I met a dude in the woods just last night or two nights ago, I guess, that was like doing his best Jay Gatsby impression. Like, hey, old sport, like, a wonder to see you out here, a glimpse of civilization in the wilderness. And I was like, fuck off, and like wearing like a, he may as well have been wearing a fucking cardigan, you know what I mean? Like, gave me his card, like, and that character was not good in any way. I met another dude who's like a nature photographer, and it's like, it's so incongruous with the tone of the camp, which is, I think, the thing that maybe is the thing that works best for me in this game. I like waking up and doing chores in that camp. I like waking up.
I like hitting R2 to
take an axe.
You got every bite. I was trying to explain this to a friend of mine while we were watching the Bears game, and he was just like, you have to hit R2 every time to eat your soup? And I was like, I know, it's great.
Yeah, I love it.
I know, it sounds ridiculous, but it's very good.
It's one of those things where, like, I can't... I've seen a lot of people on Twitter be like, why isn't there just fast travel immediately? Why do I have to, like, hit R2 to shoot to, like, not just to shoot the gun, but to actually recock certain guns? You have to, like, hit it twice in certain cases if you're aiming down the sights. Why do I have to, like, the animation stuff is very much like The Witcher in terms of there being a lot of animation and it being very momentum-driven and very kind of, like, you could say awkward, for sure, in terms of, like, methodical is probably sure. the way that we talk about it, right? That's a better word. I like all of that stuff in a way that is just like a genuine like. I have every reason to be like biased against this thing, but when I like slowly get off my horse and pat the side of it, when I'm like walking through town at this like slow pace and I'm targeting people and going like, howdy, hope your day is okay or whatever. When I'm like,
make sure you hit L2 instead of L1. I'm still getting that down, so I got in a scrap with someone that he was just coming by on his horse, and I hit L1, which my gun came out, and he was like, "Whoa, partner!" Yeah. And then I just didn't put it away fast enough, and he was like, "Well, you've escalated things," and he shot me, and I shot him back. And he died, and then that was where the game introduces the "you should probably hide the bodies" mechanic. Sure. And I'm like dragging this poor soul's body off into a bush because, like, you can pretty much kill anyone out in the wilderness without any sort of consequence as long as you sort of get them off the road.
Because otherwise, someone will see it, they'll go tell the cops, and the cops will show up, right, and like start to investigate it. I've had cops come to investigate main story mission areas where, like, you just get into a huge gunfight between two gangs and I'm like, I'm just gonna loot all these people, and then you hear the horses coming and the lawmen are like, hey, what happened here? And it told me I could try to talk them down and convince them I had nothing to do with it, but boy did I not hit that button right, and instead immediately was being chased through the woods. And, like, this is the stuff that works the most for me in this game, is it as an open world, you know, anecdote generator. I think that the writing in the main camp has been good in terms of just, like, I like checking in with people. I like doing the rounds. I like getting coffee in the morning and, like, going around being like, hey, Mary Beth, how are you doing? Like, what did you get up to last night?
Putting a couple dollars into the tin. Like, that feels good.
That stuff feels good. It feels like I'm contributing in a way. I think that there is a really strong argument. I saw Dia Lucina make this on Twitter, that, like, so much of the open world and so much of the story are both about you being always in the right place at the right time, always being, like, the world does not secretly there. This is not a clockwork world that is moving outside of you. You are the primary mover, right? You are the person who is always there right before the gunfight begins. You know, when the bandits are coming down on the father and son who are building their house in the woods, you're there at the right time. You're there at the right time when the bar fight breaks out. You're there at the right time when the lawmen are chasing somebody and you could be the one who can save them. And I think that that is a really, I think that's already a common critique about games in general. I just think it's extra pointed here, given that so much of the effect that they're going for with the heightened realism and the incredible intense detail and all that stuff is about trying to convince you that the world is real and that it's moving on its own and all that stuff. I think that there is an incongruity there. It hasn't really negatively impacted my experience yet, but I really want this game to keep leaning into moments that push me off of the path that I want to be on and into trouble. And so we'll see if it does that stuff. You know, I'm still probably only 20 hours in or something like that. I haven't checked. I'm further on than Patrick is, but I haven't moved camp yet is what I'll say, Patrick. Like, I haven't, my understanding is there are multiple camps.
It seems like you could spend 30, 40 hours before meaningfully progressing the main story, if you want.
And I guess I'll say is I don't want to leave it on just like, and that's my good time with Red Dead. Like, I think we are all having complicated concerns in terms, again, of the labor stuff. But also, there's a lot that just is fucked in this game. The menus make no sense. They're exhausting.
So, can we talk about the saving thing? So, this game doesn't... There are checkpoints. Mm-hmm. This game checkpoints for you automatically, like a good video game in 2018 does. So if you die, you can go back a little bit and pick up where you left off. But there are moments where, like, especially if you're out in the world, the game doesn't communicate to you when the checkpointing occurs, right? There's not like a little horseshoe in the corner that's like, cool, you're good. Like, that's where the game has checkpointed you. It's all kind of handled in the background. You're just sort of trusted. So, but when you're out there, like, collecting pelts and just sort of exploring, you know, I like this morning I had, like, I'd gone for, like, 45 minutes where I'm like, I don't know, like, would I just lose this 45 minutes if I, like, fell off my horse and tumbled down a canyon? Like, you can't, that can happen. Like, the physics can get really funky and you can die in weird ways. And so I was, like, looking for where to save. And it's, like, not, you hit pause. It's not in the main list. I went to three different, like, I went to settings. It's not there. There's, like, progress, story. And under one of them, finally, you find the ability to do a hard save. But I recalled the reason I hadn't remembered about that for a while was because when I looked, like, four or five different times in the first 4 hours of the game, when you're largely in hand-holdy tutorial missions, the game will just straight up say, you cannot save right now. So, like, if you're in the middle of a mission, you can't do a hard save. Like, the game is relying on the checkpoints at that point. So it says, like, straight up, like, can't save at this moment. And it doesn't communicate to you, like, when you can, when you're allowed to, when should you wait. Like, I did a search. I found a GameSpot article that was, like, explained, here's how you save in the game. And I was like, if the game has to if I have to read an outside fact to explain how to save, like, it's one of those, like, the game is overlooking basic foundational elements of its design in pursuit of things that are bigger, as though it already got that part right when it does not. And the UI and menu stuff is, I generally think it's pretty bad in this game.
Is it trying to do something narratively? Sorry, go ahead, Rob.
Yeah, I mean, it feels like, well, it's trying to do, I think, quite a bit narratively. I think it's pulling from a lot of different influences. There's a bit of, it's tough because the game's had such a long development cycle. To what degree is it, like, pulling from The Witcher versus, like, both of those developments were a little bit already thinking along similar lines? I don't know, but this feels like it definitely has some influence from that. But in terms of the controls, what it feels like is they want a world where you can almost live in it and get up to the activities that a thief / gangster / frontiersman / hunter would all get up to, in that time and place. But they can't have one control scheme that accomplishes all of that. It's just too much that could happen in the world for that to easily map onto a controller. And so they've relied on a kind of Baroque mix of contextual controls so that, like, it feels like things in certain situations are possible that you cannot just do outside of those situations. And then it also has things like a lot of button combos. It feels very much, it's a little Marvel versus Capcom in places, like the whole firing a warning shot thing. They've got a way for you to do that. But it also, you have to remember, this is how you fire a warning shot, which is distinct from how you bring up your quick inventory, which is distinct from how you navigate that. So it never feels intuitive. It reminds me a lot of Spider-Man in this huh. sense of, like,
sure. Yeah.
There's a million things this game wants to make possible so that you can, like, fully invest in the fantasy. But it doesn't have an elegant solution for that. And so what they've done is they've created this, like, nesting doll controller configuration to try to let all things be possible in the right places in the right time, provided you remember how the shoulder buttons and triggers completely change meanings between scenes. And so you will talk to somebody rather than blowing their head off in a saloon when you meant to say hi.
Well, and so I had forgotten, I can't remember what, so I wanted to look about what button press does. So I just went into the options menu, and then there is, like, a spot to look up, like, what the actions of each button is, both in, like, you can change the context, whether you're on a horse, whether you're in third person, you know, blah, blah, blah. But, like, there are so many actions that even the one I was looking at, which I think was, like, what does the controller do when you're in third person? It doesn't stay on that. It, like, fades between what, like, the the B option is for like a control for that button, like based on the context, even within the third person context. And I couldn't get it to stay in the spot. Like it fades every like 2.5 seconds to like the other one. So I had to take my phone out, wait for it to come up, take a screenshot. So then I could look on my phone. I was like, I just want to see what the fucking circle button does. Like just stop. Like just, it was.
Well, and they want to have a very lightweight UI. And so, like, and to like when you don't need a UI, and that's a lot of the game, it looks gorgeous. Like, just unrestricted field of view. You can change your camera angle. You can go to a really wild first person mode if you want, which is hilarious.
I love that first person mode. I sometimes
I want that to be in VR. God. I don't want to play in it like myself, but I do want to watch other people playing it. And I do. I would love to play that in like VR.
First person
for, like,
horse
an hour.
Does not work great. I'm gonna say that.
No, but it works great. But it can be fun to get into a gunfight in that mode, or to like walk around a store or whatever.
But the thing is, so like you can see a lot of this world looks gorgeous, but occasionally you need to know things like, how's my stamina doing?
Yeah.
How's my health? Like, should I be like trying to get out of this fight right now? And they, like, I swear to God, I have a pretty big fucking TV.
Yeah.
And
I sit right in front of one and
hid
have this
these
problem.
Meters.
I have a projector and it's still
it's the
tough.
Size of a dime on my screen.
So Danielle, for your to explain the way their like health and stamina meters work in this, it's a circle with an icon, right? And inside the icon is like a white, it's a tiny little baby icon.
And it's all grayscale.
It's all gray. It's all black and white and gray. And the gray is not a dark gray, I'll say, which is important. There's an icon that if it's filled up is white. If it's empty, it's red. But if it's in the middle, it's white and this light gray, which is hard to differentiate. And then on the outside of the circle, on the circumference, is a little white line just circling around it. And that is your active amount of health or stamina or whatever. The inside white icon that reduces is your core. And visually, I understand how you arrive at that. I understand how you arrive at the middle of the icon will be the core. And the core determines how quickly those things come back naturally. So let's say it's the beginning of a gunfight and you get winged by a bullet or two. Your health core is fine, which means that you can get behind cover and heal up quickly. But if you haven't been eating and you haven't been like keeping, you've been shot a bunch and your health core started to go down, then you're going to hide behind some cover and you're not going to heal that quick. And that system is fine. I think that's like an interesting way to do it, as interesting as anything else you could do. I don't know that it's like good, but I think I'm like, oh, okay, I'll learn this system and see how I feel about it in 30 hours. But the fact that like your current health or status or stamina are the tiny little line that you cannot fucking clearly see, it doesn't make any sense. Like, I don't know why you arrive at that as the solution. It's so weird.
Or like, it should be something that scales based on the context, right? Where like in a combat scenario, you're going to want to see those meters a lot more than I need to see my health meter when I'm just roaming the prairie.
Yeah.
Like, I don't need to see that. But like the fact that like the UI doesn't change in real time in any sort of meaningful fashion. I mean, like, outside, like, this is bad for us. Like, this game is like a complete nightmare in terms of accessibility.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
This game is probably not playable by all sorts of people. It's tough for us,
right.
And like we're not,
we
you know,
do this professionally.
Dealing with any sort of complications in that regard. So that's frustrating. And it's just, you know, even like small things like, hey, I'm gonna go see if I want to buy a new gun. And it's like, okay, you know, it'd be cool if I could just look at a fucking list. And instead, no, I need to open a book.
Look at that catalog.
And I need to hit R1 to page through this book to get to the other weapons. Is that cool the first time? Sure, it's a neat way to present it. The second time, just give me the list so I can just pick
at least
out
give the, option,
the
right?
better pistol.
I'm the guy who's going to want to flip through that book every time, but I 100% think that is where – there's no such thing as a perfect simulation. All simulations are biased. All simulations make prioritization and choices about what they want – where they want detail to appear. And so I think it's foolish to be like, but that's realistic. Like there's no, that's not, no, stop it. Stop it. What realism is different. There's a huge range of what realism can look like, right? Like realism in this game is people sinking into the mud after you shoot them. It's lots of animations for eating peaches and eating stew and all that stuff. It's the idea that you need to feed your camp and keep people healthy. But like, you can go an infinite amount of time without eating anything and still live in this game, right? You can go without sleep forever. There are times when you can like, they made a big deal in the previews to be like, and the hair, if you're growing the hair out, if you're growing a beard, if you cut your beard or your hair, it only goes one way. You can't get a longer hairstyle whenever you want. Your hair gets cut down. And so it's like, if you want a really cool long ponytail, you got to grow it out over the course of a long time. You can't have a buzz cut and then decide you want a ponytail. But then, like, you get to the horse customization stuff. And like, fuck it, man. What you want to do? We'll do what you want. A long tail on that horse? You want a short tail? How long you want the mane to be? You wanted it short a second ago. I cut it, but now it can be long and in braids. Don't even worry about it, homie.
They got horse wigs.
Yeah, I guess they have horse wigs, right? They don't have wigs in this game. If I wanted to buy, or like, who knows? Maybe there's another city I'll find where finally I unlock the wig dealer. But like, in other words, there are
this
always...
man needed a haircut.
Exactly. And that's the thing, is like, you're already going to make decisions about where the limits of your so-called realism are. What is the core idea that you want to communicate, right? Like, you think about a game like DayZ, or what's the new one? What's the one that's like, that has like...
Oh, that one where like you have to learn how to
learn how to pee.
And it had like the Nazi
Scud,
symbols in it.
Scoob. Scuba.
Sure.
Skunk.
People know what we're talking
Do
about.
They? Stunt. Scum. Says thank Kato. You, Kato. Scum. it's not Scud.
I mean, the game has all sorts of stats systems that actually don't, they're more just stat bonuses. Like, do you want bonuses? Then pay attention
then
to this stuff.
Then clean your gun.
If you don't want to pay attention to this stuff, it's cool, which I actually appreciate, because the ones that I find myself engaging with are like, I'm gonna feed my horse a carrot. And like, that's cool that I get a stamina bonus out of it. Like, sure. Okay. But I'm glad that they're not because the game would have to go in a different simulation direction for me to make me actually care about that stuff. So I'm glad that it's mostly light in a way that I mostly just don't have to.
The realism it wants to communicate is the realism of a certain subgenre of Westerns, right? Like, I think we talked about this in the lead up, that it felt like it wanted to be more True Grit or even more There Will Be Blood than the kind of like spaghetti Westerns that Red Dead Redemption was playing with. And I think that it's mostly effective at that through the inclusion of little details. To some degree, this is a game that answers my longest complaint about open world games, which, if you go back and read that piece I wrote for Paste, Real Human Beings, like, I've wanted to be able to, like, talk to people in an open world game and just say, hey, I hope your day is good, for a long time. I've wanted to be able to hug the person who wants a hug for a long time, or to, like, tell the person playing the trumpet that they're doing a good job. And so, like, to have, and it's not perfect still. I had friends last night saying, like, is there a way for me to tip people who are asking, or like, give money to people who are begging for money? And I'm like, yeah, totally. I did that in this place. And they're like, well, in this place, it just doesn't work if you do that. And it's like, okay, cool. Like, there's a lot of inconsistency there.
Or like, I had a situation this morning where, came across this woman on the side of the road. Died. Yep. Like, in the middle of riding, and so it had crushed her leg. I mean, she was okay, but she just could not muster the strength to get the horse off of her. So I'd pull over, and, you know, I'd hold L2, and I'd, you know, say hello, and then you get a second option that's, like, choose to help. And I'm like, yeah, all right. So I get off my horse, lift up the horse, and she's, the quest can end there, where you just lift the horse up, and she's like, I don't know what I'm going to tell my friend about what happened. But then if you hold L2 again, you get a third interaction, which is like, offer to give them a ride home. I was like, cool. Like, that's neat that I can give an optional, like, additional. I was like, I'm handed a Valentine anyway. Yeah. So cool. Like, I'll give you a ride home. The game is probably recognizing, like, hey, that's the main hub that you're using right now. So it's kind of on your way to whatever you're doing. Well, she goes, I can't get on your horse because you've got a pelt.
Patrick,
there.
This literally happened to me last night, literally.
So I went over and I was like, all right, well, I took the pelt off and I was like, all right, well, I can't bring the whole pelt back, but I'll skin it and then I'll at least get the skin. I'll put that on my horse and then I'll go get her on the horse and then we'll go to Valentine. Well, I skin it, and then it's the moment I finished that, she's like, well, okay, partner, guess I'll find my own way home. And she just starts walking down the road, and I'm like, yo. And I'm holding L2, tapping L2. No further interactions. Like, all right, well, I'll get on my horse, and then maybe I can get something happen. And so I get on the horse, walk over to her, and I'm L2, and I'm like nudging her with the horse. Like, come on. Like, get on the horse. Look at me. God damn it. Like, I skidded. Okay.
I hit a level 3 fucking deer. That was the thing. It was like, I would have left it behind if it was level 2 deer. This happened to me last night, Patrick. The last thing that happened.
This is the last thing that happened to me this morning. And I was, it was like really frustrating because I had like this really interesting series of moments. And the idea that like I was able to have that extra, it wasn't the game saying give her a ride home. It was me choosing to see if there was another interaction with the character and being given that option. And then the game not recognizing that I was doing something very routine, which is you are almost always going in between places. You will see some sort of creature, and even if it's not a legendary or a level 3 or whatever, like, it's just useful to get parts because you could sell that stuff or give it to your camp. And so it was not like I sat around for 5 minutes. It was a 30-second routine interaction that you cannot skip. You have to watch them go through
when
the whole thing.
It's even interesting. If like, it worked, if the takeaway there had been like, well, I didn't get everything, but I got the pelt and some meat. And then that story ended like, that was a really cool interaction. I sacrificed some of my hunting git in order to help this woman home.
Because I'm sure I get something at the end of that. Sure. Like, there's probably some sort of bonus payout. Or it just feels nice. Yeah, or whatever. Like, I probably get something at the end of it. And it was just, it was just really... Yeah. It was part of where the simulation falls apart, where it's like the game is so good. I mean, this is part of the problem when you head in this direction, right? Is that then... when it doesn't work,
the scenes become, damn, that
sucks because it was so close on a whole lot of these parts.
I was like, well, fuck it. I got this good deer, I guess. I'm going to go back to my camp. I went back to my camp, and because I'd finished a certain set of other missions, my camp was in party mode. I showed up, and I had a loading screen. Like, it did, like, the shot of the sky as things changed, and it took me from being, like, early morning to being middle of the, like, at, you know, late evening, and... I'm like, what the fuck is going on? And I get my deer and the pelt off the back of my horse, and I go over to drop it off at Pearson, who's like the butcher. And he's like, close for shot, man. I'm like, close for fucking butcher the deer I just brought in. It's level 3 deer. The game has warned me that if I leave carcasses around, they'll start like, someone is going to eat it. Like someone, like the flies will get to it, or wolves or whatever. But no, that my camp has gone into like celebration mode, which would have been really cool any other time, because I would have gotten back and I would have been like, oh, they're singing songs, they're welcoming a new person to the camp. Like there's like that whole night. And so what I do is like, fuck it, I'm not dropping this deer. I'm gonna hold this deer as long as I can. That way no wolves get to it. So I'm just like walking around.
That's your icebreaker.
How you doing, Mary Beth? Yeah, it's a level 3 deer. I got it.
Notice anything about me?
Notice anything different?
Is that straight?
Yeah, well, and here's the funny thing is eventually I had to put the deer down because I was like, all right, there's stuff I want to have conversations with people sitting down, so I have to go sit down near them. So I put the deer back on my horse, hoping that the horse would guard it. And then I walked over to somebody, and they're like, you got a lot of blood on your shirt. I'm like, yeah, motherfucker. Oh, I'm so mad at you.
Did you save that deer?
I did. I'm gonna wait until it's good to go. Horse guarded it. Next morning, I brought it over to Pearson. He was like, "Oh, good deer you got here." I'm like, "Fuck you, Pearson. I had this deer last night, and you know it." Anyway, I think those are our opening thoughts on Red Dead. I think we're gonna continue to talk about it and continue to like. And we kind of thought about maybe doing a letter series style thing instead of doing the kind of big final review. I think games like this, it can be really hard to be like. And here is my 1,200 words about what I think about it. Not because I think the game is so dense or so much better or whatever than anything else, but because the context, knowing the context of the labor conditions, knowing the context, or not the context, but I'm so curious to see how they continue to work talk about race and indigenous culture and stuff, but for better and worse. You know, I've heard mixed things.
I mean, like, you know, that Vulture piece indicated that there like is at least some significant subplot involving the government and native lands. You know, yes, our expectations are low, but like they continue to put their foot in it, and it's like, okay, then let's see how it goes.
Kind of maybe, you know, I think Patrick, you pitched this morning doing the letter series the way we did back with like Final Fantasy 15 as a way of like, we can keep talking about this thing, and it can be in a way that is discursive
it,
and not.
It allows us to hit a lot of different subjects that a lot of us are going to have. It's kind of like a podcast roundtable, and so I think we'll probably do one or two or three of those, depending on what people
think and think what we think, whether or not it has us for that long. Also, as a reminder, we're going to try to record the second half of our Red Dead Redemption 1 Waypoint 101 sometime this week. That'll either go up this week or next week. We're not sure yet, depending on scheduling. That'll be the rest of the game and Undead Nightmare, at least a taste of both of those things. I will probably just watch the final act of the game. I don't think it's worth me going through.
I don't
want
to play anymore of that game. I mean, it one like sort of like final tangent on that is like it is remarkable to play these games back to back just in the sheer like the way games have progressed technologically in the time in between, it is just kind of amazing to contrast those two next to one another.
I also just think in terms of like, so I think about the last act of that game, and the funniest thing is, we'll talk about this in the 101. I won't get into it here because I don't want to spoil anything. But what I will say is when I think about what we already talked about with Red Dead 1, the parts that we had some fondness towards, bits of the Bonnie storyline, I really like Landon Ricketts, the gunslinger you meet when you first get into Mexico. I like that intro encounter with him. The more mundane stuff that you do on Bonnie's farm, the sort of like, oh, I'm just helping out around camp. I'm relieved that Red Dead 2 leans into that stuff more. You know, if you told me that I could play Red Dead Online and that's going to have a camp version where all I'm doing is the open world stuff and the maintaining my camp and feeding my friends and cooking a stew and wandering around, that might be the best version of this for me. We'll see. I'll keep.
I am super curious to see what that online
train heists have to be there, right? You know, we'll see.
Yeah, I'm less interested in that stuff.
You're just more.
But I'm just with what the player interactions end up being is right. What. Because, you know, so much of GTA Online is, like, there are, like, warring factions, and there's an economy, and, like, there's a lot of... Go do some reading, like, people who have done reporting on GTA Online. Like, I have no interest in ever playing it, but it is fascinating about some of the story, emergent storytelling that happens among the player base. So I'm... Especially just given the scale of the world and the way the world is laid out and the lack of density, like, and I just... I'm fascinated to see how that actually ends
up. And again, like, I just want to end this by reiterating what we've said throughout, which is, like... At no point in this, some other quotes came out actually since we last recorded a podcast about. Was the elf stuff before? Did we talk about the elf shit?
We did not talk about the elf
stuff. So it was like on the day of release or the day before release. Some more folks. I think it was one of the Housers.
I believe it was in a GQ.
Yeah, it was a profile. It was definitely a GQ profile.
Did we talk about this, actually?
No, we talked about it in our Discord. Yeah, we did not talk about it on a podcast.
Because the Friday pod was recorded earlier that week.
It was like a Monday-style
pod. Yeah, it was a Monday-style pod that we recorded on like Thursday or something like that. There's a GQ piece that included some quotes that were just like as completely just like honest in the worst possible way about the desire to obfuscate the labor that goes in the creation of commodities. I'm gonna find
the
exact...
absolutely talked about this.
I'm pretty sure
we absolutely
did.
Talked about this.
I'm pretty sure we did.
Are you sure? Okay. Right. Well, if we did, well, then
it's been a lot.
I know.
Okay, then yeah, it would have been. I guess it was last Wednesday. So yeah, you've heard us talk about that stuff. Like that's the thing that I think of constantly now is this feeling that like don't play this game and let that be true. Don't let anyone convince you that like these games are made by magic, that these games appear on the store shelf wholly formed. Like constantly remind yourself as you're playing that like, oh wow, like people did this, including some people who aren't credited in this game. Right? Yeah. Including people who are not going to get any of the profit share because they've left the studio or because they're not high enough up in the studio or because they're not in a role where that profit share is meaningful. And you know, that is something that I think is the only way for me to play that game with a decent conscience is to partner it with ongoing advocacy. There's a piece that should show up sometime this week in which I not at Waypoint, actually. It's a guest piece over at a different site that will be about some of the conversation we've had recently around remaking the games industry and trying to make it more equitable. So just keep that stuff in mind as you play at the very least. And then, as we said last time, like find ways to actively engage with making this industry better. Because otherwise, I think we all run the risk of being extremely complicit and extremely like I'm just going to play my game and you know, just keep my head down. And I would encourage you not to do that. All right, we should take a break and then hit the question bucket and then wrap things up. Sound good?
Yeah.
All right, we will be right back.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
All right, we are back, and we have a question bucket in front of us. If you have questions, you can send them to gamingatvice.com with the subject question. Please, co-hosts, tell me if I start going down a path you've already gone down. I'm pretty sure these are safe, but we will see. This one came in from Derek from Harrisburg, who says, who sent us like a really nice complimentary paragraph. I'm skipping that part. I'm jumping to this part. There's a sort of appeal to the podcast, or the podcast has, in that you all have the freedom not only to discuss things intelligently, but very genuinely, a freedom to voice and develop half-formed thoughts in a casual way that resonates with me. Yet I find that in listening, I begin to put myself down for wasting my time in trying to engage with things without a professional outlet or any accreditation. And I think that this has a lot to do with a capitalist imperative to, if not monetize hobbies and passions, to at least professionalize them, whatever that might mean. Can any of you relate to having this sort of critical impulse, perhaps early in your careers, that gets stifled by a lack of an encouraging community, or maybe by a dead-end job? Is there any advice you could give to a listener like me who has that impulse and nowhere to go with it, no time or incentive or audience to write about it, or to write about it for, and for whom the whole enterprise of falling in love with the game feels more alienating than humanizing? Thank you, Derek. It's a good question. I definitely think I have been super guilty of like professionalizing or you know, trying to lift my interests in a way that makes them monetizable and therefore defendable, right? I write about video games for a living. I run a podcast with a Patreon where I get to pretend to be orcs and robot pilots, right? Like, it's not those things probably don't happen in my life if I'm not convincing myself that they're worthwhile in this long-term way. So I think I'm definitely guilty of that. But I also come from a heritage of just the community side of it, right? Like being in the IRC channels, being on forums, talking with friends. Excuse me, I'm sick. Talking with friends on social media, and trying to get into the loop of conversation in that way. As Rob pointed out a few episodes ago, probably like 8 episodes ago now, though, a lot of that part of the internet has changed. And so, like, I don't know that you'll just find that community on Twitter. What I will say is, like, I'm so thankful for our mods on our Discord and on our forums who have built a place where I constantly see people pushing themselves to share and engage with conversations that they might not have another outlet for. So consider going to discourse.zone and checking out some of the conversation there and contributing. Any other thoughts here in terms of professionalization?
Yeah, I mean, I find the impulse interesting, though.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not saying, like, I encourage people to pursue, like, you have a creative impulse, like, you want to, like, do something. I encourage that.
Yeah.
What I find interesting in this email, though, is just the way I'm reading it, there's also an element of, I can't just enjoy something. Like, I feel bad about just enjoying something just for its own sake with no end in mind. And I would like to have encouragement to have that other end, and then I will be able to enjoy it, like, on its own merits. And that's the thing that I want to dig into a little bit, because I think if I could go back and, like, fix my brain, well, there'd be a lot of things I'd do differently. If I could get my hands in there, I'd do a lot of things to sort of retool the way my brain works. But I think one of the things I would like to do is also get in a place where I can enjoy something and engage meaningfully with it just for me. And that feels completely unencumbered by the sense of some other obligation that I must then instrumentalize my engagement and enjoyment for some other purpose, even if it's not for money, but it has to be turned into something. And that's the thing I would like, I find that an interesting impulse. And that's the thing that like I sort of caution is that absolutely find like encouragement to pursue, like to sort of pursue your passions, like and explore your ideas and thoughts. But also I think it is helpful to get in a place where like you can just be an audience member and there's no, you know what I mean? Like that you don't need to always be the critic. Because that's kind of something that I would like to be able to do more often myself.
Yeah, I that perspective, 1,000%. I'm sure you're not shocked to hear this, Rob, but I have a compulsion to do this. I can never do anything just for fun. If I want to try grappling, I have to do it to a point where I get competitive in it. If I want to help people in some fashion, it means I have to go get certified as an EMT and then make commitments to be on an ambulance every other week. I cannot. I am incapable of just enjoying anything. If I enjoy film, it means I have to go get a master's degree in it and then teach classes in it. Like I 1,000% relate to Derek in that capacity. And boy, would I fix my brain to not be like this as well if I had the tools to go in there and rearrange a few things. But
the cautionary,
I'll
just interject here. The cautionary note I would sound about this is like the impulse is great. That impulse can also just eventually exhaust you. And like that for me is the thing.
Yeah, 1,000%. So yeah, it's great to have passions, and it's great to have passions that drive you. And maybe it isn't a compulsion for Derek. Maybe I'm really reading a little more of myself into this than is necessarily there. But all I can say is I completely sympathize with that. And also, I think it is sort of a marker of the way that there is a degree of, I don't want to use this term in the knee-jerk way, but there is a degree of elitism that you could read into a lot of media criticism, right? And that doesn't necessarily push some people away. Some people would like to join that. You know, they would like to be part of that. They would like to be credentialed. They would like to actually feel like they're in the club in some way in that. And that is something I think is good to be mindful of and is good to actually think about and good to sort of break down why that is and why that shows up sometimes.
Yeah, I share similar impulses to what everyone here has discussed, how they handle their professorization of their work. I will say there are lots of things I've enjoyed about becoming a parent. One of the things that I didn't quite expect but has been one of the greater positives personally is like the way it sort of disarms you and the way it has refocused like my worldview, my appreciation for moment-to-moment things, like the way I stop thinking in the ways that we're all talking because my focus has to be elsewhere. I literally have no choice but to like reprioritize my life because of this person and also this dog that has just come. Yeah, I know you want to be fed. It's usually fed like an hour ago, but it's fine. We'll get there. Red Dead Redemption 2 came out this week, all right, Pixel? I'm sorry.
Pixel.
And my dog was like a small version of that, right? Like the ways it like changes your routine. Like one of the things I really enjoyed about my kid is the way it is reshook like everything that I had defined about myself for the first 30 years, like good and bad. And I'm not saying you should go get a kid or have a kid in order to do that. I'm just saying one of the side effects of that, there are other ways to like have those moments in your life. One of the things I've enjoyed is that it has helped me recontextualize those bad habits I've had, and I've appreciated the side benefits of that, where I am forced to just sort of like refocus on things that both aren't about me, and then even the things that I am focusing on sometimes have an audience of one or no one, which is just not usually how I perform other bits of my life.
Yeah, I think that is all pretty accurate, I think, in terms of the breadth of responses here. Another question.
Patrick, if you're serious about having a dog, you should be running a puppy mill.
Jesus Christ. This one comes in from Jack, who says, I'm on a bit of a platformer kick at the moment, having recently played through Mario Odyssey, Donkey Kong Country, Tropical Freeze, and Jack 2. So I was wondering, I know Danielle and Patrick are big on the genre. What are your five favorite platformers if you could only choose one from a franchise?
Well, that's too much to bite off in a...
That's it. Real quick. Just give me what are your top five if you can only choose one in a franchise?
I'm not going to rank. I'm just going to start naming
the big
games,
ones.
And then I'll
work through experiment.
What that is.
You're not getting a tattoo.
I consider Mega Man 2 a platformer.
Sure.
So that's there. Super Mario 3D World is there.
That's the one Mario game you put on this list.
I wanted to go back and replay those because, like, Galaxy would probably, like, I definitely would pick a 3D Mario over a 2D Mario. I'll say that. So I really like 3D World. Well, I think it's, like, the most underappreciated Mario game. And I've not soured, but not, I'm not as high on Odyssey as I was when I reviewed it.
And also that means Jack probably hasn't played
Same boat.
So it's two, and that okay. So
all right, let's get to five between the two of you, Danielle.
Yeah. Oh, Jesus.
Okay.
I was putting my list together in the last few minutes.
No, just start listing. Yeah, we'll go five between the two of us. I think that's better.
Donkey Kong Country 2 and Donkey Kong Country Tropical Freeze.
It's
because they're two different.
No, they switch studios.
No,
pick one. You pick one.
Both of them.
No.
Banjo.
Then neither goes on. You can pick one or pick none.
Yep.
So right now we have three.
Tropical Freeze.
All right, so Tropical Freeze, Banjo-Kazooie 1. And one more. We need one more platformer.
You want a Mario?
We already did.
Mark of the Ninja.
Yo, that's a good pull, though. I love that game.
I was trying to find an alternate.
There's a stealth platformer.
Yeah, right, it's like, well, what is something that is like a platformer, but, or like, for me, it's like Grow Up or Grow Home? Grow Home.
Grow Home.
Let's get a puzzle platformer in there, too.
Yeah, what's
Let's
a good
think
puzzle?
About one of those.
What's...
Well, that Super Meat Boy is kind of a puzzle because you know you got to get through there with your fingers. Super Meat Boy is one of the best.
What's that one with the time travel potion? Braid.
Braid. That's
I just wish he barely had that has John any Blow association. That's the.
Yeah, I know.
I didn't like The Witness, but I liked Braid. Yeah. Like, mechanically,
all right,
I
think
Braid
those are good. That's a good selection of stuff.
That's a lot. That's a good time. I hate lists, so that was thank you. I appreciate that.
Rob, before you go, I need your input on one thing. I know we all have to get out of here. Rob really has to get out of here. And this is our last question anyway. It comes in from Magistrate Trofim, who says, I like sandwiches. Sandwiches are good. What is more important in a good sandwich to you? The bread or the contents? Whether that's meat or something else.
Yeah. Well, so we're assuming a baseline level of quality, right?
Yeah, like baseline bread, competent.
Like, right, because like, would I rather have great bread or great like salami, something like that?
I think
we've
defined top and bottom, which is to say, ideal and necessary.
Right. Okay. So like, what I'm gonna say is, like, the contents have to meet a certain, like, you can get away with probably worse bread, and then you can worse condiments. However, if you're going for a great sandwich, if you're really like swinging for the fences there, then it's about the bread.
Yeah, I think that's if I'm getting a fancy sandwich, if I'm like, I'm going to treat myself today, I'm going to go to a place that's like, this place is good. The thing that separates it tends to be, and I don't even think about this rationally, I'm not like, I'm going to go to the good bread place. But when I think good sandwich, part of it is like, I bite into that bread and it's just so good. It's just, it's soft or it's crisp or it's whatever that specific sandwich needs. It blends with the cheese and with the meat and whatever else is in the veggies in such a way that like brings out the best in them.
Are we all being asked this question?
Yeah, this is everybody.
Well, if you're asking a ridiculous fitness white lady about sandwiches, you know I'm going to say contents because I don't eat much bread anymore.
Oh, true. Good call. Good call.
You need that good iceberg.
Mm-hmm. You're that good. That
and
good
I'm a vegetarian, so yeah. It's
a double.
Sad. It's a sad story.
Patrick.
I don't got strong feelings. I got, you know, I like sandwiches, but I don't got strong preferences.
You don't, you'd be like, you don't, there's not like an ideal in your mind?
No.
You don't like, you never had like,
I'll
good
just eat a
ham.
Sandwich.
Oh, it's shock of the Patrick, no cold pizza, please. Klepek doesn't have like an
Patrick,
inspired
I buy
take
my
on
coffee
sandwiches.
In the biggest bulk can you can find.
Klepek. No, I thought, so
I like Fleischmann's.
I was at Costco and I was, you know, we've gone from like, I can get the Dunkin' Donuts big one at Costco for 18 or I can get the Kirkland's big one. And it's already pre-ground because I don't want to grind that stuff up. Like, it's just too much work.
Perish and, thought.
And then also there's like a low and the Kirkland, a big pre-ground bag is $11. And then, but then there's even, you can go even lower from that. And there's a tin
can
one for eight, but I thought about it. I was like, if I do this, I then have to vocalize it and I would have to tell Rob. And I can't go, like, I'm drawing the line at the $11 pre-ground bag and not the $8 pre-ground tin can from Kirkland.
God. Perfect. Good. Well, that's
I got really upset at Costco recently because they were not stocking my $17 scotch, which actually the Kirkland liquor is actually way better than
Rob just had a none Rob of, has to go.
No sign as good as when you're like shouting at a stalker. Like, where the fuck is my $17 scotch? Excuse me, where is your manager? Where is your manager? There was a handle. It was $17. I bought it every 2 weeks. A handle of this whiskey, $17.
The Makers is twice as much, and I like Makers, but Makers is the occasional drink. The
$34 for whiskey? That's
in
criminal.
This economy?
You know, $2 is pretty good.
God.
All right.
Not $2 anymore. Patrick knows what it costs now. Every time he brings it up. You know, you can't actually call this $2. You can't call $2 Chuck anymore.
You can't.
This is $4.15. This is minimum. This is 1996 minimum wage Chuck.
I have minimum wage exactly. I got to go get a minimum wage job just to pay for my Chuck. God damn. All right. On that note, on that beautiful, beautiful note, we are going to wrap it up. As always, you can find me on Twitter at Austin_Walker. Where can people find you, Rob?
Under the sea.
Perfect. Good. Danielle.
At Danielle R.I.
And Patrick Klepek.
This is at Patrick Klepek.
Find everything Waypoint does, twitter.com/waypoint, facebook.com/waypointvice, and waypoint.vice.com. Thank you, as always, to Bowen for letting us use the track Miss You off the EP Pale Machine, and shout-outs to Kato for continuing to be our excellent producer. We will be back later this week with more, some Waypoints on Wednesday, which we should put up what those are going to be probably later today, so people can have tomorrow to prep for that. And then we'll have a Friday podcast, which is also, I hear, going to be a little spooky. So that's exciting. So look forward to those. Danielle, take us out.
Be good and be good at it. And happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween. Peace. All right.
I actually jumped.